So my name is Paul Andrew. I'm a technical product manager at Microsoft. I work on the Office 365 team, and my areas are Office 365 identity and commerce. And so today we'll be talking about security and trust for Office 365. So before we get into Office 365, I want to just spend a couple of minutes setting the scene about the environment that we're in related to internet security right now. It's been maybe 5 or 10 years since IT departments had complete control over all devices that were inside of the organization. I remember when we used to use tools like system management service, and IT departments would have complete control over what was on PCs. They'd have instrumentation on those PCs to identify what was there. If new software was to be rolled out, it'd be thoroughly tested before being deployed on users' PCs. And so IT had a great deal of control over what was going on in the environment. IDC recently ran a study and found that 95% of commercial organizations had employees bringing their own devices into work and using them on their work networks. So clearly, IT departments are having less control over what is going on and having to react in different ways. This consumerization of IT is leading to a couple of things. Another survey that we have, also from IDC, shows that if you ask employees about whether they should be using Facebook at work, 67% of them will say, that's okay, my company says it's fine. However, if you ask employers, only about 43% of employers will say that employees using Facebook at work is okay. Now, whilst this is interesting, the issue there is there's a gap between perceptions of employees and perceptions of the companies. And so what's an IT department or a chief security officer to do knowing about this gap and knowing that employees trying to do the right thing and not intentionally doing anything wrong have a completely different perception about policies in their organization than their company does? In the old days, when the company controlled the IT environment, you'd simply turn off the firewall port connecting to Facebook, or you'd lock down the machine so it only connected to internal sites, or whatever you wanted to do. But with the consumerization of IT, these things are more difficult. Also, according to McKinsey and Company, between 20 and 50% of purchasing decisions are made through word of mouth. And so what your employees say on social media sites is really, really critical and really influences how people are purchasing and interacting with your company. So having an understanding of what is going on there is very important. And when an IT department and a chief security officer for a company does not any longer have the ability to say, no, you can't do that, we're going to not allow that, you have to think about things in a different way. So secondly, the second trend is targeted attacks. In the past, we used to have single-day outbreaks. There would be a virus that would come out, and it would spread across the whole world and take down millions of PCs. And then, you know, people would remove the virus, and the next day, everything was back to normal. PCs were basically unusable for a day. People would get sent home, all of these kind of things. And you really don't hear about that anymore. You don't hear about the marijuana virus or the I love you virus spreading and taking down PCs. Instead, there's another kind of threat. And we call these advanced persistent threats. Or more colloquially, we think of them as a low and slow attack. Attacks these days are more likely to penetrate an organization and do nothing, and simply wait for the employee to be in a compromised state where some particular piece of targeted data can be accessed and returned back to the sender of the attack. It's not something that's big and visible, but it's much more insidious in the damage that it can do to your organization. So today, a chief security officer must be concerned about these different kind of targeted attacks. They are advanced in that they typically have some sort of monetary backing. They are not just hobbyists who are looking into these. They're persistent in that would be an organization that has time to wait for the opportune moment to get at the piece of data that they're looking for. And they're a very significant threat to organizations, much more significant, in fact, than the old-style viruses that we used to have to contend with. So the third trend is the identity-centric environment, moving from 100% on-premise to where some parts of your organization's infrastructure are in the cloud and some parts are on-premise means identity is very different. Identity on-premise typically means you have a directory somewhere. It's a central directory for your organization. Or if it's not, you have you at least have your arms around what the different parts of the directory structure are. Moving to cloud means that typically directories are disconnected and that you have separate directories for different cloud applications that your employees use. And so this does lead to employees using common passwords or writing passwords down, and you have a hole that's opened up because of this. And so managing your identity-centric environment and the differences that this distributed identity means is another significant trend that is impacting the security of IT departments. The fourth one, cloud computing, of course. Cloud computing means simply that some of your systems are not inside of your corporate firewall. So there's a difference between users who could get their password wrong, try alternate passwords on other people's accounts from inside of your building, to where someone can attempt to hack into your systems and your systems are actually out on the internet somewhere. So there's a big difference in how you have to think about securing those systems, and there's a much higher level of concern that you should have about those. And the last one, number five, is the increased role of government in cybersecurity. Many governments around the world, Australia included, are taking active roles, forming committees, investigating the security of data and the privacy of data inside of organizations. And with this increased government awareness come new regulations. There tend to come new compliance requirements where, as the person responsible for security in your organization, you have to meet these requirements, you have to understand what they are, and you have to take steps to prove that you're adhering to them. So regulatory and compliance issues is another trend, not a trend necessarily in a bad way, but certainly adding to the overhead that's required for a security officer in the current day. So with that as background, I'd like you to take a look at this screenshot. Does anyone remember this screen? It's from a long time ago, MSN Hotmail. You can see available in English, French, Deutsch, and Japanese. Microsoft has been doing cloud services for a long time. So I want to just point out some of the things that Microsoft has been involved in cloud services. You can see the introduction of MSN and then Hotmail there when Microsoft purchased that company in the late 90s. Microsoft has been building cloud systems, software as a service, if you like, more recently platform as a service, infrastructure as a service for a great deal of time. Our first data center back in 1989, the Microsoft Security Response Center, if anyone's familiar with that, the Microsoft Security Response Center has a lot of importance at Microsoft, has a lot of power over different groups wanting to deploy software or release software. The MSRC essentially is the first line of defense if a security exploit is found in any Microsoft software. They have the ability to hold development teams accountable. They also have the ability to patch software directly and release patches if they see fit. That team, as you can see, has been running for some time. Microsoft introduced the Trustworthy Computing Initiative after a memo from Bill G, which took into account a much more serious nature of internet security. And the Trustworthy Computing Initiative has been running for more than 10 years now. The Trustworthy Computing Initiative was a very broad initiative at Microsoft, which built on the Microsoft Security Response Center and introduce some policies and requirements of developing software at Microsoft, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But that's a very important team for making sure that everything that we ship, whether it be software that you get on a DVD or software that is deployed to the cloud, is secure and should be considered trustworthy. Microsoft also has a thing called the Security Development Lifecycle, which has been around for almost 10 years. This lifecycle, which I'll go into a little bit of detail in the future, actually is a large set of policies and procedures all throughout building software and testing it and deploying it and operating it and managing it at Microsoft that helps to make sure that software is more secure. Now, why I'm showing you this is all of the learnings and information that Microsoft gets from running these data centers is brought back into the policies and guidance and understandings in the way that software is developed in our cloud services. So having this long tenure of experience in cloud services means that Microsoft is uniquely positioned to be able to develop data centers that are secured and is something that we can be fairly confident in the security of. If a single company is saying, hey, I'm going to move from on-premise and I'm going to move into the cloud, if a single company is going to go and build their own data center and get into that kind of hosting game and do that for themselves, I'd argue that without having this background, there isn't as much experience and procedures that you can bring to bear from that learning. So Microsoft has a distinct advantage in this game. So before I get into the talk, this is my third one, I know, but I want to call out some recent news. There have been recent leaks of data from the US government National Security Agency and involving all cloud software providers, and this has stirred up a lot of discussion in the community. I'm not a spokesperson on legal issues from Microsoft, and so I just have a few notes here from what Brad Smith, Microsoft's general counsel and executive vice president, has published on a blog. I want to show you the place where you can look at that. Where is it? Here. So we have this blog at blogs.technet.com, the Microsoft on the Issues blog, posted by Brad Smith. And so I'm just summarizing a few points out of this blog post. I'd encourage you to go and read that to learn more about Microsoft's response to the various public discussions that have resulted from these NSA leaks. So from that blog post, Mr. Smith made 4 points. That Microsoft does not give direct and unfettered access to customer data. If a government wants to access customer data, it needs to follow the established legal process. Microsoft is, of course, going to follow the various laws that governments across the world enact, and we're going to abide by those laws in all of those countries that we operate in. However, governments, if they do want to get access to data, they need to follow their own laws. And Microsoft has compliance teams which will evaluate that those requests are valid before responding to them. So if Microsoft does respond to requests, they are for specific accounts and they're not generic in nature. And I mentioned about the compliance team. So in that blog post also, there's two specific things that are called out about Office 365. One is that Microsoft has never provided any government with customer data from any of our business or government customers for national security purposes. So that's the text from the blog post. However, there are also law enforcement requests which are separate to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was being talked about primarily. We do a report every year of law enforcement requests. In 2012, the report shows that we had 4 inquiries for Office 365 or business customers. In 3 of those cases, Microsoft was approached directly, and we notified the customer of the demand, and the customer in all 3 of those cases asked Microsoft to provide the data. In the fourth case, the customer received the request directly and asked Microsoft to produce the data. So I just wanted to call that out. Microsoft is trying to be very open about what has been requested and what hasn't been requested related to this. Brad Smith has followed up that blog post that I showed just a bit earlier with additional requests to the US government to be able to share more information about what those legal requests are and how we are responding to them. So it's all about data privacy, and Microsoft believes that commercial and government customers own the data for the Office 365 tenants that they purchase. In the first instance, we always refer requests of a legal nature to those customers because it's their data that's being requested. We take our customers' data very very seriously. We do not advertise to customers. We don't use customers' data for advertising. We don't send marketing emails to end users of those customers either. We believe that in data portability, customers' data belongs to the customer. You can download it. You can take it off the service. You can also report on what Microsoft might be doing with that data or any access that's required in order to fulfill support or service-related outages and correct those. You can report on what Microsoft has done there. We don't do mingling of business customer data with consumer data. And we're transparent about where your customer data is stored. We'll let you know for each part of the service, each workload, where that data is. None of these are really true for our primary competitor. And we work very hard to make sure that we are selling you a service. We are not selling you as an advertising product. All right, so with that up front, and I hope maybe that has answered some top-of-mind questions about Office 365 and security. There are three parts to this talk, which I'll go through over the next hour. And the first is talking about Office 365 built-in security. So this section, I'll share some of how our data centers are put together and how they're secured. In the second section, I'll talk about customer controls or things that as a tenant administrator, an owner of the data, you have control over the security inside of that tenant. And the third is talking about verification and compliance. And the nub of this section is really because we find that customers are very interested in our security. If you want to sign up and use Office 365, ideally you'd like to go and look at the data centers and see how we're securing them. And we've found that that's not very scalable to take customers around and make sure that they don't get near other customers' data, but they still get access to look at the data center. So we actually don't allow data center tours as a general rule. Instead, we provide third-party independent verification of the various certifications that we have, and we provide that certification to you to take a look at and review what independent people have looked at. So we'll talk about that verification and also government compliance with government regulations that we have undertaken. All right, so the first section here is built-in security. So these are the six areas that I want to talk about. And let's first go to our physical hardware. Now, I have a brief video here to show you. Number five. Microsoft data centers are managed by a part of our organization that is called Global Foundational Services. They manage all of the physical data centers, the network environments, and the security of those. So they have actually published quite a lot of information from that group about how we go about doing that. I have just a brief video that I want to share with you about some of their work. And could we have the audio up, please?
Security at our data centers employs outer and inner perimeters with increasing security at each level, utilizing a combination.
Can we have it a bit louder?
Security at our data centers employs outer and inner perimeters with increasing security at each level, utilizing a combination.
Okay,
of
it looks like we're not going to get
physical measures.
Audio.
Technical elements include two-factor access control.
So he's talking about two-factor security of getting access to the premises. He's talking about how regular Microsoft's employees, such as myself, can't get access to data centers. We have security monitoring here. We keep customer data separate. If hard drives are considered have high business impact data, we'll actually shred those hard drives after they're removed from service. And I think he was talking about a fence there right at the end. All right. All right, so let's see. Talking about 24-hour monitored physical hardware, there's two perimeters at our data centers that you saw a glimpse of there on the video. We have fire suppression systems, the controlled access we talked about. Our data centers have video monitoring and surveillance for what's going on. We locate them in areas where there is unlikely to be seismic activity, so not near any fault lines or volcanoes. You don't want to put a data center on the side of a volcano. We tend to locate them where there is readily available power and internet connections. All of our data centers have multiple significant network connections. Microsoft has one of the largest contributors to the internet across the world. We have private networks, dark fiber between our different data centers and multiple connections onto the network grid. We have multiple days of backup power. I toured one of our non-customer data centers and the generator in the back of there looked like it had come from the underneath of a cruise ship. It's just this enormous big diesel engine with the diesel being stirred so that it stays okay. We also have contracts for additional backup power where we can roll in additional spare generators or additional diesel fuel in order to keep the power going. We have many tens of thousands of servers in all of these data centers. And it's very serious business keeping these things going. The GFS service, it is possible to get tours of our non-customer data centers. It's very impressive if you're ever visiting Microsoft corporate for an executive briefing. I highly recommend taking a look, particularly at some of the work that's being done to reduce the power consumption of the data centers. We use cooling that does not require refrigeration. So cooling using damp sponge technology and interesting ways of getting the power use down of some of those environments. Very interesting stuff. So let's talk about customer data isolation. We mentioned already we separate the consumer and commercial services data. Customer data for our business services is largely separated by Active Directory organizational units. We make use of the technology that's been in Windows NT since the dawn of time. It's a well-proven technology for separating data. And so whilst Office 365 is a multi-tenant system, so there will be multiple tenants using the same physical hardware, data is logically isolated, and it's not possible for one customer to see another customer's data. We have an internal network in all of our data centers. Whilst our endpoints for the different servers and workloads that we have all have publicly accessible IP addresses, they are built within our internal network. And so our internal network spanning the data centers has connectivity through to the public network through separate firewalls or edge routers, which we're able to use for filtering, for detecting and blocking intrusions or denial of service attacks that may exist. We keep those networks physically separated so that there is minimal chance of access between the two. We have data encryption on our servers. For our Exchange servers, we use BitLocker. BitLocker encrypts all the data on the disk, and this protects essentially against a disk being lost or stolen. If a disk which is BitLocker encrypted is taken out of the PC and you do not have the BitLocker recovery key, you can't recover the data off it. It's required for PCs, of course, at Microsoft, in case we lose PCs or hard drives while we're traveling. And we use that on our Exchange servers in Office 365. We don't currently use that on our SharePoint servers. On our SharePoint servers, we have rights management services, or information rights management, to quote the Office brand there, where content can be encrypted. We'll take a look at that rights management services in just a little minute. We also use TLS, which is based on the Secure Sockets layer, for connections between our servers and connections between a web browser or client applications and our servers. And we support third-party technologies like PGP. We also support S/MIME for encryption of emails. So lots of data protection options there. All right, talk a little bit about our administrative requirements. Yes, it is required that some Microsoft staff have access to the servers that customers' data resides on. Of course, maintenance and operations requirements, also outages potentially lead to these requirements for Microsoft staff to have access to those. We use a new technology that's been developed specifically for Office 365 known as the Lockbox, where a pre-screened admin on Office 365 must request access. And that access has to be requested based on a bug that's been raised, a service request that's been raised. So when a service request has been raised, an admin can request access. And based on the access request that they're doing, they may need to have undergone background checks. They may need to get additional permissions from their manager in order to have the access. And once that access is granted, there's a temporary privilege increase where an admin theoretically has access to customer data, or at least has access to the disks where the customer data is stored. And this temporary privilege will expire after a period of time, and if that's not enough time for the admin to go about their business, they have to make a request again. So this process gives us a number of benefits. We can minimize the number of administrators that actually have access to customer data in the raw number of administrators who can actually go through this process. There has to be a service request from another part of Office 365 in order to request that access be granted. We undergo checks on the background potentially a manager approval for the employee, so there is some sort of second man involved in making those choices. In addition, because we follow this process, we have an audit trail of every administrator who has accessed every customer's data, and we provide reporting on that audit trail to tenants. So if you have an Office 365 tenant, you can go in and run a report and see what administrators have requested access to be able to get at your data. We have a number of other administrators who work on the various servers that we have without needing any access to customer data and don't have to go through this process. So we separate out operations that may involve access to customer data from other operations so that we don't overload our administrators with paperwork going through different things where it may not be required. So this is the process that that we go through for operations data. All right, so the last part here to talk about is Microsoft security best practices. And there's four areas that I want to talk about security best practices. And this is building on what we talked about a little bit ago with Microsoft's experience in running data centers and running cloud and keeping customers' data secure. So first, I wanted to talk a bit about the security development lifecycle. If any of you have a development background, you might think, oh, SDL, the software development lifecycle, he's going to talk about waterfall software development. Well, it kind of started with the software development lifecycle, and Microsoft has various processes for running software development. which has changed over the years. But this is about the security development lifecycle. It's about the lifecycle of developing software, but in all aspects of this timeline here, what we're talking about is how we train people, how we do software design, how we review that software design and implement it and operate that software with a view to avoiding security exploits. And if you remember, before the Trustworthy Computing Initiative started at Microsoft, there was a lot of talk in the community about how poor Microsoft was at security, and how the best way to have secure software was to not use Microsoft software. So that's really turned around in the past 10 years or 12 years since Microsoft began this initiative. And the security development lifecycle is one of the ways that we have turned that around. The Microsoft Security Response Center is another way. Really, Microsoft has become a leader in software development that is secure and unlikely to have exploits and issues found with it. So we start with training. Development teams must undergo security training on an annual basis. So if you happen to be a software development engineer and you're working on some software at Microsoft, regardless of whether you are straight out of college or if you have 15 years of experience, you have to undergo annual security development training, teaching you about buffer overruns or whatever else the training du jour for security is. Requirements in the requirements development, there are separate sections where security requirements have to be called out and discussed. In the design phase, a very onerous task called threat modeling has to be undertaken by the development teams. Threat modeling is about thinking about all the possible ways, getting advice from security consultants about how software might respond to certain threats, and then developing a plan to react to those threats up front and mitigate the possibility of those threats. It's a pretty significant piece of work. Analyzing the attack service, doing static analysis, and using approved tools, fuzz testing, all these are either automated tools that we run against software or against source code that we have developed over the years for identifying potential issues with security in software. There's at least a half a dozen of these different tools which have to be run on software today between the time that the code is written and the software is released either to customers or into the cloud. And then come release time, all of this work has to be documented, so there's release management work that has to happen, and an incident response plan has to be developed. An incident response plan is essentially the contract between the group at Microsoft that builds the software and the Microsoft Security Response Center, where the Microsoft Security Response Center, if anything does happen and there is an event, then they can look up what is the response that the team created for that event. They know where the source code is that is related to the product that has anticipated, that has happened that event. They have home phone numbers of developers that they can call, detailed in that incident response plan, and they have an outline of what that software is. So someone who is on call in the MSRC can really make an informed decision about what needs to be done, who needs to be contacted, and how to very swiftly close off that incident. All right, so let's talk about throttling for a minute. And this is primarily talking about what Exchange Online have done for throttling. SharePoint Online and Link Online have implemented some of these to a lesser extent, though, than what our Exchange Online team have done. And throttling is about avoiding denial of service attacks. Why do we want to avoid denial of service attacks? So a denial of service attack is some sort of targeted attack against a web-based or online system whereby the person initiating the attack is attempting to deny service to other users. So if I have a single web server and somebody connects to that web server from 100,000 robot-owned machines, then it's very likely that a web server is going to be overloaded with 100,000 simultaneous connections, and it's not going to respond to valid connections. You're going to get a 501 error, or you're just going to get no response whatsoever. The network stack, the RAM is just overloaded, and sometimes we call it a meltdown. So a denial of service attack on a single server is pretty straightforward. A denial of service attack on a major internet site like www.microsoft.com is extremely difficult because there are simply a lot of servers and a lot of network connections, and it's really hard to do. For a SaaS service like Office 365, we're somewhere in the middle. We're not as big or as simple as www.microsoft.com. We're clearly a lot more sophisticated than a single server that's out on the internet. However, we don't want our customers to be impacted at all by any kind of denial of service attack. So we do a couple of things. We work on our ability to recognize denial of service traffic patterns, and we do that through manual means with our on-call staff and also through automated means. And we have automatic traffic shaping, which kicks in when spikes exceed the normal pattern that we expect from different customers, different endpoints. There are four different types of denial of service attacks that we experience at Office 365. There are simply non-malicious excessive use. Maybe a particular tenant has decided on this particular day to ramp up from 5 users to 50,000 users. This could cause an overload for that particular user, and it takes some time to make sure that there are other servers online to cope with the demand, and this could be detected as a denial of service attack. Buggy clients sometimes cause detections of denial of service attacks. If, for example, a mobile phone and an Exchange, an EAS client on a mobile phone decides to make requests to our servers just over and over and over again, two things are going to happen. One is the battery in the phone is going to run down really quick, and the second is we're going to identify that client as a potential denial of service attack. The third is admin actions. Sometimes admins can do things which appear as denial of service attacks. A couple of examples of those would be a load test. We specifically ask that customers don't do load testing on Office 365. Load testing typically involves running up a number of clients, automating them, and hitting the service all in one go and seeing what load it can take. If this sounds very similar to a targeted denial of service attack, it looks exactly the same to Office 365 as well. We ask customers not to do it. We can provide details of the loads that we can support, and we will treat those as denial of service attacks. And then real denial of service attacks, and we see those as well. So traffic shaping, what that does, or another thing an administrator might do is an administrator might necessarily be running a series of PowerShell requests against the service to do some programmatic operation. And we have somewhat more polite ways of slowing down administrative requests that customers need to do, which is potentially overloading our systems or causing a big load on our systems, but is nonetheless necessary for them to make some change. For example, an administrator might need to modify the Active Directory properties on 300,000 users in their tenant. This is going to appear to, and sometimes people will do that on multiple threads and from multiple machines so they can get it done faster. And our service is going to notice this, and at some point it will start to introduce delays into the responses to those, just so that we don't impact the service for other users there. So we use traffic shaping. Traffic shaping simply means if we notice something that's excessive, we're going to introduce delays to the response so that those excessive use from various of these four different occurrences do not impact other customers. And as a result of this traffic shaping, manual intervention, IP blocking, this sort of thing, we can be very confident that for regular users, there's going to be no impact to their service from these types of things. All right, so what do we do to prevent a security breach? So here's some of the things that that we work on. A security breach obviously means if a tenant or if Office 365 itself was breached and some external organization was able to get credentials that gave them some internal access. So there's a load of different things that we talk about doing here. External port scanning of our service and remediation for that, patching the OS and keeping them up to date. DDoS detection and prevention. We have multi-factor authentication for legitimate use of our service. whether that be the physical access to data centers that I showed on the video, or whether that be administrative network access, multi-factor authentication is also required, and also auditing. So then, some other things that we do here, automatic account deletion. If employees have administrative access to various parts of the service, for a little while, part of my role was to do a particular administrative job on the service. I was never in this role. I wasn't given access to any customer data, and I wouldn't have been eligible to that. But I had access to some of the administrative use of the systems. I found that within about a short amount of time after I stopped doing that work, I received notification that my access was revoked. And it took quite a bit of time to get it in the first place. We were able to find some other group that would take on that work that I was doing. I'm a technical product manager, not an operations person, so we were able to do that. But certainly access is revoked very, very quickly after employees stop doing the particular work. I know in a lot of organizations or groups, when access is granted, it's very rare that access is then revoked from different systems without something significant in place to watch that. So what else have we got here? Automated tooling for routine activities. It's not necessary for administrative staff to write code run those on the servers. We have isolation between production access and the employee's email or other productivity application environment. So when you're administrating one of the Office 365 servers or one of those server farms, you are not on a machine where you can access your email. You're isolated from your regular work machine here. Such that you can't accidentally, inadvertently share files between those two environments. So, some things of how we prevent breach. How do we mitigate breach? We don't encourage hackers or illicit organizations from attempting to breach Microsoft systems. And there's very little that I'm allowed to share about how we go about mitigating our breach. But we do work in each of these three areas. We do work to detect breach. We work on responding to that breach and taking appropriate action. We audit everything that goes on the service to make sure that we know where potential breaches are occurring, and we hit those before they can get very far. All right, so I have another half an hour, and we're going to talk about some of the customer controls next that are available for Office 365 tenants. So I hope that's been interesting. We've talked about some of the built-in security that Office 365 has, some of the ways that we go about securing the service and making sure that it's rock solid and that we look after it. The next section is much more external, outside of our data centers, or at least things that you can access on Office 365 and do with the tenants that you have created. So, Office 365 customer controls. And then, of course, we'll come to that next section, which is the independent verification and compliance. So the first bit of customer controls that I want to spend a little bit of time talking about is the rights management services that we use in Office 365. Rights management services can provide encryption for documents as they are stored on your local machines. Those documents can be encrypted as they're transferred between SharePoint Online or Exchange Online and your local servers. Rights management services allows you to view those documents in any authorized client that is able to decrypt the rights management the information rights management stored document. What IRM in Office does is it provides a way of having the document encrypted essentially at all times, and then only decrypting that document when an authorized user is viewing the document in an authorized client application. So if you have a document that's in Exchange Online and it's been emailed to you and it is encrypted, it's been encrypted with IRM, when you go to open that document in Word, Word checks, do you have permission to open this document? And if you do have permission, it's able to get hold of the decryption key, and it's able to decrypt that document and show it to you on the screen. If you have permission, you can also potentially edit that document, forward it, and print it. If your permissions are such that you aren't able to do those things, then all you'll be able to do is view the document. And screen copying technologies are disabled while you're viewing that document in Word. You can expire information rights management policies. So if you've received a document on email and it's encrypted with IRM, then that can expire after a certain period if you decide, such that users can only view the document for a certain period of time, after which point it's simply an encrypted file for which you don't have the key and can't access. IRM is implemented across Exchange and SharePoint. SharePoint provides the ability to encrypt an entire document library. And when I say encrypt an entire document library, the documents are not encrypted inside of the SharePoint document library. They're encrypted as they come out of the document library. So we encrypt them with rights for the user who is viewing them and once they're transferred off the SharePoint system. All right, so I want to switch over here and my demo machine back. I want to show you a few new things that we've done for information rights management in Office 365. So first off, I'm looking at Outlook Web Access on an Office 365 client here. And Outlook Web Access has the ability to read information rights management encrypted emails. So when you encrypt an email with IRM, you're encrypting both the email. So the email is an encrypted blob of bits that has to be decrypted so you can view it. You're also encrypting any files which are attached to that email which have the capability to be encrypted with information rights management. So if you attach a file which is, for example, a source code file or a text file, these files don't have the capability to be encrypted with IRM, and they are not encrypted. And when you're sending an email and you IRM encrypt it, you'll get a warning of that. If you're using files such as an Excel spreadsheet here, then that file is able to be encrypted with IRM, and so it's encrypted as part of the email, and it can be decrypted by Excel when it downloads it. And recently we've added the ability for Excel web access to be able to decrypt IRM attachments as well. So give it a moment here to decrypt that email, and we can see the Excel web app start up, and I can view that attachment, although it's in fact an encrypted file that's been sent to me. All right, so I want to take a look also in Outlook Web Access, where we've added the capability to write, manage, encrypt emails that you send right in here from OWA. I can go in here and set permissions for do not forward, and you can create custom rights management permissions. This example will prevent a person receiving the mail from forwarding, printing, or copying the content. And so this is something you might do if you had some confidential material, or you just wanted to ensure that that material is not forwarded on to other users in the organization. All right, so our Outlook Rich client has supported all of these for some time. We've just recently added these two features into Outlook Web Access. Let's take a look here at SharePoint and what you can do with IRM and SharePoint. So in Office 365 here, I'm just clicking over on the Sites tab. Just thinking about it. Are you sure you want to leave the page? Oh, yeah, I'm sure. All right, so I'm logged in here as Sarah Davis, you can see. Let's go in and look at a document library in here in SharePoint Online. So here's a document library. It's been customized a little bit with a banner, and I can go into the documents that are stored here and take a look. Here is an Excel spreadsheet. And if I open the menu here, this is just a standard SharePoint preview here. The SharePoint preview cannot view information rights management protected files. And you can see here that it's telling me it can't show a preview of this item. Let's go in and take a little look at the configuration for this library and what we've done here. So if I go into the library settings, I'm just going to show you how this library is configured for rights management. It's information rights management section here. You can see that all I needed to do was tick this checkbox and say restrict permissions on this library on download. This means that any time the document is loaded out of the library, the permissions are restricted, and you can specify a permission policy which users will see when they do that. There's quite a lot of details that you can get into to specify what those permissions should be. You can block file types that cannot be encrypted with IRM from going in here. You can turn off the restriction after a certain period of time. This is a common requirement if you're working on something that is company confidential, and at some point you're going to go public with that material, then it makes sense to turn off that IRM so that people can easily or more easily share documents, particularly with people who are outside of the company. You can allow or block each of these particular access rights separately, you can also require, you know, that people refresh their credentials while they're using the content. So there's a bunch of different configuration options that you can do here. Now, there are three things that you need to do to configure a SharePoint document library for rights management. This is the first one, and this is just in the document library. You go in and you check the box. Let me show you the other two. I'm going to go into the Office 365 administration for SharePoint here, and I'm going to go into settings. And in settings here, this is the configuration for SharePoint Central Admin as part of SharePoint Online. You can see there's an information rights management section here, and I'm enabling information rights management for my SharePoint deployment. By default, this do not use IRM for this tenant is checked, so you need to go in and check this box. You actually cannot do that initially because information rights management relies on a Windows Azure service called the Rights Management Service. If you've ever deployed information rights management on premise, you know that you have to stand up a server that basically holds the keys and does the encryption. Well, for in the cloud, this is done with the Rights Management Service. And so this screen is the second place you need to configure rights management inside of SharePoint. Let me show you the third place. I'll go into Office 365 Admin. And then I'm going to click through into the Windows Azure configuration for my tenant. I don't think I'm on the event Wi-Fi. Well, this is a polar bear in a snowstorm in our data center. We're going to think about that for a moment. Here it is. So the Office 365. It's not. It's still loading there. I wonder if I can. So service settings is where I want to go. It doesn't look like it loaded all the Chrome, but I'm going to hit it up, try for service settings anyway. And now I've managed to get myself mixed up here. Oh, yeah, yeah. So rights management over here. Okay, so I went to Office 365 Admin, I went to Service Settings. I'm showing you this because it's a little bit hard to find. And then Manage. So, Rights Management and Manage. And we're going to get into Manage. This is the third place that you have to configure Rights Management to be able to use it in SharePoint Online. It's a really valuable feature. It's really worthwhile going in and turning this on and being able to use it in your document libraries. So, is this? Oh, okay, it came up. So, now I'm actually in the Windows Azure. You can see windowsazure.com here, where I'm configuring the rights management service that my tenant is using. And you need to go in here and click Activate. That's all. You just need to go and turn that on. OK, so rights management. All right, I better keep moving. It looks like I've got about 20 minutes to go. So, rights management over other approaches. These slides are available to you. There's a nice chart showing why rights management is fantastic. I won't dwell on this too much. I have a call out here on third-party encryption gateways. Third-party encryption gateways are becoming popular to increase security of data that's sent between a customer site and a Microsoft gateway. Microsoft doesn't support these third-party gateways. They are third parties, they're not produced by Microsoft. We don't test with third-party gateways. We test with the regular internet and standard connections that customers have to Microsoft. We don't recommend third-party gateways. Customers who use them may encounter a loss of functionality. There may be compatibility issues. It's possible that we might introduce a patch to our software that does something that stops working because you're using a third-party gateway. So we're just a little bit concerned about this impacting customers' use of our software. There may be supportability issues that you have as a result of this. Some of the features in Office 365 that may be impacted, advanced search features where you're running SharePoint search across your data, hybrid use where you may have on-premises data and cloud data, which is very common. Lots of customers have some kind of hybrid, whether it be email or search or SharePoint or just identity. Data loss prevention, which we'll look at in a moment in some detail, may be impacted. Anti-spam, antivirus, exchange transport rules. So we have a few concerns over these third-party encryption gateways. So user access. How do users get access to the service and to your tenant? We use Active Directory in the cloud, which is known as Windows Azure Active Directory. You might use Active Directory Federation services if you want to federate that directory service with your on-premise application. We support multi-factor authentication. This is currently in preview for Office 365, but it will enable you to use a cell phone as a second factor of authentication for your administrators who are using your Office 365 or your end users. So we've recently introduced support for that in preview. Sorry about that. We have various policies and rules that you can set for client IP address, location-based, hours-based access to Office 365 that you can specify. So another part of compliance and security that you have control over is data loss prevention. I know data loss prevention has come up a few times at different talks at the conference. I wanted to show a quick overview of what it does. Data loss prevention allows you to specify rules to identify data which should not go outside of your organization or should not be shared within your organization with the most common of file sharing technologies, which is email. Data loss prevention is built on exchange transport rules, and so we review content that is sent from one mailbox to another mailbox and make sure that content doesn't violate any policies that you have. And if it is, we'll block it, send an NDR response back to the sender, and also audit that. We have little pop-ups that can appear in Outlook to warn a user if they're sending something that might violate a company policy. In some cases, you might want to override those. And let's see how we're doing. I'd love to demo data loss prevention and just show you briefly what it looks like. So let's go into number 5 again here. All right, so I'm logged on here using Outlook, and I'm connected as Garth Fort on my demo tenant. So let's just go and create an email and show you exactly what data loss prevention looks like to an end user. Let's grab some innocent enough customer data, drag it into my email, and let's say I want to send that to Sarah. All right. So there's two parts of data loss prevention, which I'm showing you. One is purely a pop-up inside of Outlook, which will disable a send button and show you a little highlight. It's not working in my Outlook right now. But if I go ahead and send that, I haven't had the pop-up. It hasn't noticed the policy. The Exchange Transport Rule is going to block that email, and it's going to bounce it back to me. The reason it's going to do that in that case is this customer data has credit card information in it, and I have a policy that's configured on this account to block credit card information. Hey, let's take a look at how that is configured inside of your Office 365 tenant. So let's go back to my tenant here, and I'll go into the Exchange admin site. I think we're switch back to Exchange admin. These demos always load faster when I'm in my hotel room rehearsing prior to coming along. Let's go into compliance management and data loss prevention so we can take a look at that. All right, so all of data loss prevention is done inside of Exchange. Configuration for these policies, which impacts both the pop-ups, which I didn't show you there, and also the Exchange Transport Rules, which actually block these things. Here's the policy which I have right now. If I go into that and edit it, you can see that this is a called PCI credit card. And you can go and take a look at the different rules, notify if it's an external recipient, notify if it's an internal recipient. And this particular policy is set so that if you're sending credit cards to an internal recipient, the user who is sending the mail can override that policy and send it anyway. You can configure that to be a button in Outlook, or you can configure it to be a keyword on the subject, so a user can literally put in override or some other text to send the data out. For an external recipient, this is blocked entirely and not valid. I can look at these individual rules and see what's in them, and you can see some of the breadth of different things that you can configure in these rules. The recipient is external, internal, the attachment, the message, all this kind of stuff. And then the message contains sensitive information, what kind of sensitive information, you can specify all of that. There's three different ways that you can configure these rules. One is by going in and configuring this manually and setting up all these in the UI. The second is by using some of the out-of-the-box rules that we have, which I'll go and show you here. And we have 44 of these different out-of-the-box rules. The third is by creating a custom DLP policy, which is shown here, which is by creating a policy in XML and then uploading it into your service. So let's go ahead and look at what we are doing for creating one from a template here. And I wanted to show you this template policy because the templates include a number of policies that are unique to Australia. We have policies for different regulations and different types of data from all over the world. You can see we've got some for the HRIP Act here. And for specific Australian personally identifiable information and for the Australia Privacy Act. There's a lot of customizability that you can set in these policies. You can specify that, hey, we're not going to block email, but we're going to audit it. We're going to have any time a user is sending some personally identifiable information, we're going to send a copy of that email to the privacy officer in the organization so that they just have a notification of what's going on. You can, when any of these policies is created, it's set to test first so that you can do reporting on the policy and what has been happening with it. You can also report, of course, on policies that have been breached and what users have been doing about that. So it's a quick look at data loss prevention. The two-second explanation of it is it's about Exchange Transport Rules and helping users to do the right thing with regards to information sharing within and outside their organization. All right, so I'm going for 10 minutes left, and I want to talk to you a little bit about compliance and certifications that we have. So I'm going to move a little bit quickly here for a minute. We have a very comprehensive anti-spam, antivirus protection that's available with Office 365. We block a large number of spam emails coming through all our services. All right, so let's get on and talk about the verification. And we really talked about this a little bit earlier, which is that Microsoft works really hard to provide customers with evidence of third-party verification of international standards. This all started with the ISO 27001 standard, which has been adopted in various forms. It's an international standard. It's been adopted by many countries with specific standards related to that, with minor modifications. So we've worked to get certification to that parent standard and have also been working to get local standards for people. I talked about the audits that we do that we can provide information about. Here's some of the certifications that we have so far. We've seen a big uptick in law enforcement organizations wanting to use the service with that CJIS accreditation that we've recently got in the United States. Each of these certifications that we work through sees a similar uptick in organizations in that industry or group being able to take advantage of it. Hey, one thing that we do is we're transparent about where our data centers are located and where customers' data is stored. For North American customers, there you go, our data centers are in across the US, South America in the US, and also in Brazil, specifically for Brazilian customers. We have a data center there. For EMEA, we have data centers in Dublin and in Amsterdam. And there's certain parts of the data which are stored in North America. Link online is mostly point-to-point communications. There are some parts of the link servers which store data, and so we've disclosed that data is stored in the United States. For APAC, there's a similar story. For link online, we store data in the United States. Our primary and secondary data locations for Australia and other parts of APAC are in Singapore and Hong Kong. We have Active Directory primaries in Dublin. For Active Directory, of course, we have DCs in each of our data centers so that we have fast access to that data, but our primaries are up there in Dublin. All right, so I think I'm right about on time. I've maybe got 7 or 8 minutes left. So I just wanted to give a summary. Whoops, sorry about that. A summary of the three different areas that we talked about today. And I apologize, I jumped over a couple of those slides. If you have questions about those areas you saw, you're welcome to call them out and let me know. Security and trust is something that is really critical to Microsoft and to Office 365. We value our customers very highly. We're in the business of selling a service, not selling customer data to advertisers. And so we work really hard to build that trust and make sure that we have a service that customers can be confident in. So there's three areas that I talked about. The first was built-in security, what we do as Microsoft to protect the service. The second is the customer controls. We looked at information rights management. We looked at data loss prevention, that you can take an impact on the security of your data. And the third was third-party verification and certification. Why do we do that? Because we want you to have the confidence in our systems without you having to go through the hoops of saying, hey, Microsoft, I want to review your data center and make sure that it's up to scratch and that you're doing the right thing. We want to make that easy for you. Another part of the verification and trust is we have a thing called the Trust Center, the Office 365 Trust Center, and this is a website where we publish a lot of different information about customer privacy for Office 365, our transparency of what we share about where the data is. We share the verification, the independent certifications here. We share information about our security plans and policies, and we share information about our service level agreement and what we do for service continuity. What we do in the event that there is a service impacting event which might breach our reliability. We actually recently published our uptime for the past quarter, which was 99.97. Our SLA is 99.9. It's possible that some customers have experienced outages and are able to claim that SLA credit, even though our overall uptime is 99.97, where an individual customer has had some kind of outage which has been caused by Microsoft. So across the whole service, though, our uptime is pretty significant there. All right, so that's my my summary here. I'll just click through some of these so that you see these required things. I encourage you to come back to the slides and make use of some of these resources that we have here. And I'd also encourage you to do an eval.